places, total strangers with familiar faces. I could never forget that look in your eyes, but you've already forgot me once we said our goodbyes. I won't let that be the end. There's something I can still defend. Know it's somewhere deep in your heart, fire and love, that spark can start. You know I love you to death,
love you to death.
I'll keep fighting till my last breath. You're the woman I love and I simply adore. I long to have you in my arms once more. You know I'll never forget,
never forget
how you left that night with no regret. The pain from that moment still haunts me today. The specter of love that's gone.
RCT Pittsburgh.
You want to start?
Yeah, do it in D.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to this week's edition of Ebony Spectrum. We have several items this week to reflect on what's happening in the news.
Kamala Harris unveiled a new economic plan to provide more opportunities for black men, part of the Democrats' broader effort to secure the black vote. Theodore R. Johnson is an expert on this issue. His new book, If We Are Brave, Essays from Black Americana, tackles race and democracy. And he joins Michelle Martin to take us through those firsthand accounts.
Thanks, Christiane. Theodore Johnson, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You're kind of a different animal when it comes to, you know, sort of punditry per se. I mean, you know, 20-year Navy veteran, You are a columnist for major news outlets, and you're an author. So it's kind of hard to pigeonhole you, just like it's kind of hard to pigeonhole this book. Like, how do you describe it? What do you think this book does?
The book is an essay collection in sort of the traditional sense of the term for Black writers in particular. I mean, it's probably too much praise, but I think of it in the same vein of writing as like the Harlem Renaissance and the essayists of the civil rights movement that were very rigorous in their journalism, in their research, but had a common touch in how they relayed very complicated and complex issues to a general public. So I sort of think of my career as providing the perfect background or a set of life experiences that allow me to tackle big topics in essay form while also incorporating the very rigorously researched insights that I hope to bring forward in the writing.
I see it as reflections on what it means to be an American. It's reflections on democracy, but from a very distinctly African-American, you know, perspective. Why did you feel we need to have these conversations right now?
Yeah, so most of it is because there seems to be a fight over the identity of this country and the people that belong here. Some folks want to take us back hundreds of years, and others say we've actually not realized the potential of the country. And so maybe we should be doing the work to get us to that place, which will require, an engagement with the idea, the identity, our history, and sort of meditate on what does it mean to belong in this country. So it tries to take big ideas, democracy, affirmative action, police brutality, racism. And instead of talking about structural racism or the need for criminal justice reform, I wanted to talk about the experience of people in this system, the experience of Americans, white, Black, all races, ethnicities. All of us are living in the same system that's underperforming what it could be.
One of the interesting things you do, though, in the book is you kind of compare the experience of understanding your Americanness. And you compare that in your experience with being a person of faith. And then you kind of draw that as an analogy to how we kind of fall in and out of love, if I can put it that way, with the democratic experiment, with the American idea. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, and so you're absolutely right. The first essay, the lead essay, is essentially Ted Johnson's sermon on democracy as delivered by this Black boy from North Carolina who grew up going to church 3 or 4 times a week. And so it's almost like this is my conversion story for why I believe democracy is the way forward in America. And the reason that's important is because democracy's legitimacy as a system writ large is an article of faith on every person who participates in that democracy. If you don't believe that the outcomes of the democracy are legitimate, it results in catastrophe. We don't have to guess at this. We were all around for January 6th. We saw what happened when the legitimacy of institutions and processes are questioned. People die, systems get overturned or unraveled. And so we have to believe the system is worth investing in if we're going to commit to the work of making it more inclusive and to the work of reforming it. If you don't believe that democracy is the answer, it's very hard to get people to invest in voting, to invest in the political system and its outcomes, to see those outcomes as legitimate. And that if we're committed to the both the country and the process for improving the country, then outcomes can be better than if we don't believe in the country and believe that the system is no longer useful. Then we're at a different starting point, which could turn very ugly very quickly.
Well, I can make an argument that it's already turned very ugly very quickly if you consider that on January 6th, people died. You know, we're really lucky that more people didn't die, but a lot of people were hurt. A lot of people, particularly our first responders, lost their careers, if not their lives, because they were so badly injured they couldn't work again.
It's ugly. But in the 1960s, a president was assassinated. A attorney general and presidential candidate was assassinated. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, assassinated. Medgar Evers, assassinated. Hundreds of protests in the summer of 68. The Vietnam War protests where students at Kent State were killed. So if we think January 6th was bad, our grandparents would say, children, you have seen nothing yet. And this book is both a meditation on democracy, but also a warning that if we don't heed history, if we don't heed the life experiences of those who came before us, we, as the old saying goes, we are doomed to repeat these things. And January 6th 6th, then instead of becoming this this terrible day following a presidential election, mm-hmm. becomes the beginning of a terrible decade, like the 60s, like the 1860s. And we've got an opportunity to avoid that outcome, but only if we get ahead of the problem now.
I want to read something from the book. You say you're talking about your plea, your desire that people engage in this reimagination, as you put it. You said, reimagination, however, is tricky business. It arises from the premise that who we are is no longer sufficient or is deeply flawed in some way. Ego, whether personal or national, does not mm-hmm. like confronting the truth. It's uncomfortable and invites an identity crisis. When a nation as large and diverse as the United States is overdue for a reimagination, those at the center of the national narrative are likely to feel threatened. I mean, you can understand why people who have been historically left out of the national narrative want in. But why should the people you're talking about here who see themselves as threatened or on the being displaced or not wanting to be dominant, why should they participate in this kind of reimagination that you talk about?
Well, if they truly believe in the founding ideals of the country, not lip service stuff, but if they truly believe in it, they don't have a choice. You know, I think Jill Lepore, the historian, has said that in the first presidential election in 1790, 6% of the people in this country were eligible to vote, and only half of them did. The story of our democracy is the story of excluded people seeking participation. And when they are denied that participation, they are also Americans. And Americans don't take lightly to be told, you're less than, you don't get to have freedom, it's just for these other people. You don't get to have liberty and rights or access to democracies for other people. So if they do not make democracy a more inviting exercise, if they do not make the country more inclusive, they will have to contend with the people they've excluded outside of democracy. We've had a civil war to answer this question. We've had a civil rights movement to answer these questions. People were lynched trying to get a better answer out of this question. Suffragists, you know, abused and beaten trying to get better answers out of this question. But what never stops is the sort of spirit of progress. The second part of this, which sort of follows from the first, because we're a nation of 330, 50, 40, 50 million people. And if you think that democracy is only for 70% of those 350 million people, you squander massive amounts of talent and capabilities of your populace. Countries do not thrive when they squander the thing that makes them special, unique, which is to say their people. So not only will those people not stand idly by, but those at the top that want a prosperous America or want to sort of hog the benefits of this country for themselves will find that there's less benefits, less resources, less good feelings to go around when exclusion is your politics.
But what about people who just don't see it that way and seem to believe, whether through force, through violence, through the ballot box, through domination, some kind of way that their narrowing of the American story is going to continue to prevail. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so the first thing is on January 7th, January 8th, January 9th, a lot of the people saying that 2020 was an undecided election or a fraudulent election, on January 7th, 8th, and 9th, they were saying, how dare Donald Trump? You know, this is beyond the pale. This is too far. And then what they learned was you don't get reelected. You don't have a chance in the Republican Party if you hold Donald Trump accountable for January 6th. And so they changed the positions they held on January 7th out of political expedience. Now, This is the kind of character that our political system incentivizes. That's a fault of both the system and those politicians, which leads to the second point and sort of the one of the major arguments in the book. This is why Black Americans have always insisted on a strong federal government enforcement of civil rights, because if you leave it to the goodwill of our representative or of our representatives or elected officials, you will be disappointed every time. When the folks who founded this country said, we don't have to worry about a republic or the Electoral College or all these things, because the people that staff them are going to be patriots who are going to put justice and equality first and not put their partisan and faction leanings first. And they were wrong. They're wrong then and they're wrong today.
So let's talk a little bit about the current sort of political moment. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting that we see, and you know, we'll find out soon enough whether this sort of pattern holds, but you do see increasing numbers of African-American men and Latino men seeming to be drawn to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump in particular. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I've got a few reasons for this. The first one is between 68 and 2004, Republicans averaged about 11 or 12% of the black vote in presidential elections. And then Barack Obama came along. And in 2008, Republicans get 4%. In 2012, they get 6%, about the same 6, 7% in 2016, and then about 8% in 2020. So in between 2008 and 2020, it's gone from 4% of black voters choosing a Republican candidate to 8%. So it's doubled. That makes it seem like, wow, Republicans are making inroads, when in actuality, Barack Obama has left the stage. So that's one reason why we're seeing a little bit of an increase. Black Republicans who didn't want to vote against the black guy have sort of returned back to their voting habits pre-Obama. Here's a wrinkle that I think is new. It isn't the same folks returning. It's younger folks coming. And I think it's mostly younger black men. And the question is why? Some of that is because Trump presents as very hyper-masculine, not in his sort of appearance or in his energy or vigor, but he presents as untouchable. The man has 34 felony convictions and may be president-elect in a month. There's something very masculine about doing whatever you want and having no comeuppance, paying no penalty for it. And so if you take young black men who have been told the police are out to get you, the democracy is unfair, the system is unfair, this idea that you can do what it takes to get forward and not be held accountable, or that no one's coming to get you, can be appealing. It's hyper-masculine in its untouchableness. So that's some of it. The other part of it, and I think this is, we're going to have to watch this. I'm Gen X. That means my parents were born during Jim Crow, and my grandparents were also born during Jim Crow. That meant in my generation, your grandparent was probably in the Deep South under Jim Crow. For Gen Z, their grandparent may be in Harlem, or in Los Angeles, or in Chicago. And that is a generation removed both from the South and from the civil rights movement. And I bring this up because a lot of black political, sort of political science around black voting behavior talks about this idea of linked fate, that we're all in this together. And a lot of that stems from this very shared common experience that our grandparents or parents had. And now that we're a generation or two removed from that shared experience, the idea that that kind of solidarity will be enough to hold black people together in the same party at a 90-10 clip, I think, is outdated.
The other thing that you hear is that some of younger voters just think that the Democrats haven't delivered. They just haven't delivered. And that they haven't delivered on, you know, at least sort of Trump in his idiosyncratic, you know, sort of individualistic way has delivered, or at least he likes to tell you that he's delivered. Does the fact of the change at the top of the Democratic ticket help or hurt in any way? I mean, does Kamala Harris as the nominee, even with this foreshortened election period, does that change that dynamic at all?
Yes, 100% it changes it. If for black voters that are looking at the Democratic Party and saying, what have you done for me lately? Like the old Janet Jackson song, they're not asking that of Republicans. They're looking at Trump and saying the promise of what they want to do around the economy or immigration or whatever sounds good to me. So I'm going to take them at their word over the evidence from, say, a Biden presidency or an Obama presidency. But now you're voting not for Trump against Biden, but for Trump against an AKA from Howard and Kamala Harris. And again, even with the sort of shifting, a small realignment happening in Black America, you are still Black in America. And if you decide to vote against the candidate, a black candidate at the top of the ticket that probably 88 to 90% of black folks are going to vote for in the upcoming election, you're not just making a political decision, you're also making a social and cultural kind of choice. And there's great work out there, my political scientist, that shows there's a kind of social constraint that happens when black people are running for office among black voters. And you don't want to be the dude that walks into the barbershop to say, I voted against Kamala Harris for this dude who thinks Haitians in Ohio are eating cats and dogs.
Is part of the issue here, though, for black people who've been continually disappointed and disillusioned by the Democratic Party, is that the Democratic Party isn't perceived as continuing to fight those fights? I mean, like voting rights, for example, on issues like that. I just wonder if that's part of, you think, the calculus here.
So my sense of it is actually a little bit different. The latest numbers I've seen is about 1 in 5 Black folks identify as conservative, about 40-45% identify as moderate, and then about 1 out of 4 identify as liberal. And I think for a number of Black voters, and we saw this in the Democratic primary in 2020, they think the Democratic Party has gone too far left, and maybe addressing concerns beyond race, and feeling like they've been left behind, despite the fact that they're the party's most loyal base. And so if we look at the primaries in 2020, Biden loses in Iowa, and New Hampshire badly loses in Nevada, and then shows up in South Carolina, older Black voters, a little bit more conservative, and wins, and they rescue his campaign. Same thing Black voters in the South did for Bill Clinton in 92. And so if those are the folks that are putting these Democrats into the White House, if they think that president is suddenly going to lurch far left and accomplish a number of very, very progressive ideas that they didn't sign up for in the primary, which is why they voted for the moderate or even establishment candidates in previous primaries, the party has misread Black voters. And I think to some extent, maybe particularly in their rhetoric more than in their policy proposals, that has happened. So I think you're seeing more of a more pragmatic Black electorate rejecting the leftward lurch of the Democratic Party in some circles and the rightward, you know, lurch of the Republican Party sort of as a party writ large, and are kind of left to sort of make sense of politics given these two realities.
So before we let you go, I am wondering of who you want to discover this book. Who do you want to read it, and who do you want to take it to heart?
So that's a great question. This is as much for Black people to say, this is the conversation we've had in a million places. Let's get it on paper and sort of reflect on what it means in this moment, as it is for white audiences who only hear about race on cable news or in their echo chambers or in their sort of preferred social media, you know, curated feeds on these different platforms. They should read this book, because this is how you understand racism in America. This is how you understand what Black people say when they say the police are racist, or that structural racism is the reason why there's such disparity in the country, and see it presented in a way that doesn't demonize the country and doesn't make Black people victims in the nation's story alone.
Ted Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, everyone's weighing in these days on politics and the election. So, Stephen Smith, who has been on the sports scene for many years, has become very popular over the past year with some of his different interviews. And, Stephen weighs in.
I have to get started with some politics because I've had something on my mind that I've been holding in for the last few days or so, and I'm not going to hold it in anymore. It's specifically the presidential election, which is just over 2 weeks away. National polls show former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris essentially in a dead heat heading towards November 5th. Both campaigns were on the trail over the last week or so, including this weekend, including some of their surrogates as well. And for Kamala Harris, that would include former President Barack Obama, who hit the trail stumping for Democrats. The former president made headlines this weekend, actually a few days before this weekend as well, speaking to a forum of Black men in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Obama spoke directly to all men who may be considering not voting or voting for Donald Trump in this election cycle. Before I go any further, I want you to hear exactly what this man had to say.
I've got a problem with that. Because part of it makes me think, and I'm speaking to men directly, part of it makes me think that, well, you just aren't feeling the idea of having a woman as president. And you're coming up with other alternatives and other reasons for that. And so now you're thinking about sitting out or even supporting somebody who has a history of denigrating you because you think that's a sign of strength, because that's what being a man is, putting women down. That's not acceptable.
Respectfully, President Obama, what you said is not acceptable. I'm going to say it again. Respectfully, what you said is not acceptable. Not to me, not to a host of black men out there who's not even thinking about voting for Donald Trump. What you said is unacceptable. I'll tell you why in a minute. But before I do that, I want to go to Khalil Thompson, co-founder and executive director of Win With Black Men, who responded to criticism of Obama's comments. Take a look at what he had to say here. Quote, I believe President Obama is speaking to a tangible, visceral understanding of what it means for all men to relate to women in America. Calling out misogyny is not wrong. End quote. To co-founder Khalil Thompson, you're wrong too. And what you said is unacceptable. You see, what you're missing is that you're basically accusing black men who come up with a reason to not support Kamala Harris as engaging in misogyny. Whatever happened to disagreeing without being disagreeable, President Obama? What happened to that? All of a sudden, we want to challenge men and our love and our affection as black men for black women. We want to bring that into question because we've got an election coming up and people may have the temerity to think differently than you. It's because she's a woman that she's in danger of losing this election. Didn't Hillary Clinton win the popular vote in 2016? Didn't she get over 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump in the popular vote for the 2016 election? Last time I checked, she's a woman. Are we there sitting here and implying that black men would be more apropos to support a white woman than a black woman? Is that what we're saying? Is that what we're saying? It's a rhetorical question because it makes no sense to me. Before I go even further, let's hear more from Mr. Khalil Thompson himself. Quote, we're not a monolith. However, we are just like every other American in this country who wants a good paying job that we can provide for our children and participate in their lives and the lives of our partner, that we can get them home safely, afford to go to the grocery store, save a little for retirement, and have a vacation. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that explanation, Khalil Thompson. Why didn't you say that from the jump? What's up with the misogyny comments? I will have you know, and President Obama, our 44th president of the United States, who I voted for not once but twice, who was the president from 2009 to 2017, who to me was exemplary, who to me had the greatest first lady in the history of this country, who has been a phenomenal role model to black people and to black men and the men across this globe. That same Barack Obama, how could you say something like that? How could you ignore the facts that are lying in front of all of us? You don't want Trump to be president. We think that Trump could be an unmitigated disaster. In my opinion, he'll be on a revenge tour. In my opinion, there's a lot of things he bloviated about and didn't deliver on. We don't want to get into too much about COVID. We don't want to get into much about him overblowing his contribution to HBCUs, the wall that he was going to build, and the Mexican was going to pay for it. He ended up building 2% of the wall, and the Mexicans didn't pay a dime. We could get into a whole bunch of stuff about him. That's a given. I understand that. But let's get back to the part about black men. That's what we're going to talk about right now. That's what we're going to talk about. President Obama, why didn't you tell the folks with the cameras rolling and the black men in attendance that there's been diminishing black voters, particularly black men, since you were in office? In 2008, 95% of the black populace voted for Barack Obama. It dipped in 2012. by about 6 to 8%. It dipped another 6% in 2016 when Hillary was running. It dipped even more in 2020 when Trump ran against Biden. It's been dipping since 2008. It didn't just start. Was that about misogyny? Was that about a hesitancy to support our women? I am getting sick and tired of black men being raked through the coals because of some imagery of not being supportive of black women. Do you know what most black men would do if they saw a black woman getting harmed in the streets? They put their lives on the line for that sister. We talked about the absence of black fathers in the past. What do we do simultaneously? We applaud the mothers who've uplifted us, who've nurtured us, who've made us into who we are. I can make an argument. No one loves women, particularly black women, more than black men. No one. You must know this. Black men support the Democratic Party more than everyone but black women. That means we support the Democratic Party more than white women, more than white men, more than Latino women, more than Latino men, more than Asian women, more than Asian men. Nobody, in terms of percentage, supports the Democratic Party more than black people. Black women first, black men second. Even as we sit here today, as Kamala Harris is neck and neck with Donald Trump, she's getting at least 80% of the black vote, according to the polls. And if there's a question mark about her, why don't we tell the truth? It may very well have nothing to do with her, per se, but what she has inherited. You have a president in Joe Biden who has his own history. Don't get me started with the crime bill of 1994. We want to bring up Trump in the 70s and rent control and all and denying rent to black folks. We don't want to bring up Biden and how he got along with segregationists in the 70s. We don't want to bring up how Kamala Harris, then a presidential candidate in 2020, called him out for his support of segregationists when it came to busing. We want to ignore that. You don't think black people heard that? You don't think there's some trepidation in the hearts and the minds of black people from time to time? At least from the past? Not even talking about what he's done during this administration, which some people will believe his policies and his heart have been in the right place in some of their eyes. You're President Obama. How do you ignore that? Inflation, the cost of living, the price of gas, the price of groceries. That don't matter. Folks ain't paying attention to that. Immigration and our borders. And this belief that there's an elevated level of sensitivity towards them, as opposed to black folks struggling, if not starving, in this country. Yes, that plays a role too. I brought it up right here on this show. When the mayor of New York was talking about $53 million in prepaid credit cards for immigrants who came across our borders illegally and having prepaid credit cards for them. And I said, wait a minute, black folks been starving for years. We ain't get that. You don't think they notice? You don't think they notice? Is it possible that the only reason some black folks, not me, but some black folks may not be inclined to vote, or they may be a bit disenchanted, or dare I say may even be willing to go as far as voting for Trump. Is it possible that it's policy as opposed to misogyny? Is it possible
that they looked at a Democratic Party that has locked in on addressing or not addressing immigration and folks crossing the borders illegally, and have prioritized focusing on that along with other issues, identity politics and beyond, that has become such a focal point that has turned off folks in the African-American community. Some, not most, not all, just some. Is that possible? And is it possible that that is the reason why even Kamala Harris herself has become a bit more assertive in addressing the issue of immigration, in addressing the economy, in addressing a plan for Black America as it pertains to facilitating more business loans for minority ownership and things of that ilk? Is it possible that Black folks, particularly Black men, more so than the Black women, who you look at Roe v. Wade and the women's rights and what have you in Trump's position, they're like, he's got no chance in hell alluring them in. But is it possible that when it comes to the men are saying, wait a minute, get all that, but what you gonna do for us? Could it be the issues as opposed to just misogyny? You know the answer to that question better than me, Barack Obama. The right may have a problem with you. Folks on the left, Democrats, progressives, you're revered. As a Black man who is an independent, you are an incredible role model and somebody that I have admired for years. But to say that to Black men, to attribute their hesitancy, their reluctance, their reticence to support Kamala Harris, to you just don't want to support a woman, really? Respectfully, sir, that's messed up. That's a messed up thing to accuse Black men of, when you know good and damn well there are a plethora of reasons for us to point to than that to justify our apprehension. Doesn't mean you ain't gonna vote for her. Doesn't mean you don't want her to win. But my Lord, is it a crime to not be ultra excited when you see some of the choices that are before us, and you see the decisions that have been made and the messages that have been disseminated? A Black man asking, what about us, is not a crime. It's not misogyny. It's us exercising our rights as American citizens to question why you should have our support, which you yourself as the president for 8 years told us we had every right to do. That's all I'm gonna say for now. Love me some Barack Obama. Always have, always will. Just very disappointed that you would say that to Black men who are a bit apprehensive. I'm voting for Kamala, so you weren't talking to me. But still, it's not right for you to say that, sir. It's just wrong.
Next, we have Roland Martin and Karen Hunter weighing in. Listen to what they have to say.
Now, new polling from Pew finds that there is a larger gap between gender for each candidate and support. So 51% of male registered voters are supporting Trump and 43% supporting Harris. More specifically, 20% of Black men support Trump compared to just 8% of Black women. And as each candidate pulls out all the stops to get support, recently former President Barack Obama hit the trail for Harris, directly reaching out to Black men. Listen to this.
To have someone who has consistently shown disregard, not just
for the communities, but for you as a person. And you're thinking about sitting out, and you're coming up with all kinds of reasons and excuses. I've got a problem with that.
All right. So I want to bring in journalist Roland Martin, host of Roland Martin Unfiltered. Roland, thank you so much for coming on with me today to talk about this. First, I want to ask you, what do you think about former President Obama's approach? Because, you know, you've got people on both sides. Some say that they're glad he's saying the quiet part out loud, that, you know, if you're, for many people, he says, basically, if you're not going, is it misogyny? But there are other people who say that, you know, that tone isn't what's going to help get that support of Black men.
Wrong approach, wrong tone, wrong message. This is the reality of the data. In 2008, Obama got 95% of Black male vote. Republicans got 5%. In 2012, Obama got 87. The GOP got 11. That was two men. Now, the number goes up in 2016, where 13 points go to the Republican. And then, of course, then you go to 2020, it's around 18. Now, here's the problem here. Obama lost 6 points. And so it's not misogyny if you had two men who are running. So what's going on here? And that is, you have the Democrats, many of these Democratic white strategists, have not crafted a Black male specific strategy. What I mean by that is, since the civil rights movement, African Americans less self-identify as Democrats. So the younger you go, so 55 plus, more self-identified. The younger you go, less self-identified, which means Democrats have to work harder, spend more resources, communicate with voters today, because they're also choosing the couch. Now, Janae, here's the other thing. A lot of these polls you're seeing grossly underrepresenting African Americans. I've had on my show 8 to 10 Black only polling from Black Voter Project, from Black Pack, Higher Heights, and other groups. And in none of these polls are you seeing 20%. So I don't think he gets 20%, but it is an issue that Democrats should be addressing. The problem is they're not, because they're trying to still do the, you know, broad, you know, throw it all out there, reach everybody the same way. And you can't do that with Black voters in 2020.
You know, to that point, this is something that the vice president has spoken about and says that she believes that, you know, for any group, that their vote needs to be worked for. They need to be spoken to. But what do you make of the increased support that there appears to be by young Black men for Donald Trump? Well, the former Obamas of the world are saying, you know, that there is a history of racism there.
Right. But again, though, you also have to look at, in many of these polls, when you go underneath them, Chris Toler of the Black Voter Project does an excellent job breaking this down. Many of these are folks who are being polled who haven't even voted in two or three elections. And so there's a difference between registered voters, likely voters, and non-voters. And so that's also skewing a lot of the data. But let's say they actually do vote. Many of them are also voting based upon economic issues. That's one of the issues. You do have among, again, men, this is a male trait, whether you're white, male, Hispanic, Asian, you want a strong person, a strong leader. Do you have misogyny as part of this? Absolutely. But to put it solely on misogyny is wrong when the numbers increase, when two men ran. And so Democrats have got to do a much better job of messaging. What Obama should be talking about, and other men should be talking about, other Black men, what Biden-Harris has done specific to African-American men when it comes to economics, when it comes to health, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to mental health, when it comes to fighting white supremacy, criminal justice reform. Talk about what you've done as opposed to chastising what someone should or should not be doing. Speak to their issues. That's how you reach them.
So to that point, then, what do you think that former President Trump needs to do to reach out and get the support of Black male voters?
First of all, he doesn't give a damn about that. So one of the things you are going, he just doesn't. He's appealing to white voters. Republicans have always, in the last four or five cycles, want to just peel off a certain number. And so you're going to have Trump puts rappers out there. You're going to see him, you know, trying to tout what he did with the First Step Act, but that was also passed by Democrats in the House and strengthened by Democrats in the Senate. So you're going to see that as well. But Trump's strategy is not to appeal to black men or to black women. It's not. It is to appeal to his base, which is white voters. And so that's really what that is.
And so the Harris campaign is launching a Souls to the Polls effort to turn out black churchgoers in key states. Even today, she's meeting with some black faith leaders in North Carolina. But evangelicals are pushing for Trump to be elected for his views on abortion, LGBTQ rights. How much of an impact do you think religion is going to have on who people are voting for?
Well, I think also we got to parse the data. White conservative evangelicals are pushing for Trump. Most of your black evangelicals are supporting Harris. And so that is an issue. And she's making light of, again, him being a liar, a narcissist, and also his own personal failings. She's making character in issues.
And now some words from Karen Hunter.
Oof, that was Barack Hussein Obama getting candid. Some people didn't like it. I live in a world where two things can be true. Is this finger wagging? Some of us need our fingers wagged at us. Some people need their fingers wagged at them. Some people's behavior needs to be examined. Who is he talking to? I always operate from the standpoint that if it doesn't apply, let it fly. If I'm not the target, I won't answer. I don't answer to people calling if it's not my name. So if you're offended by this, should he have said it? I felt like he said that with his full chest. Like he meant that. Like that was not a political pandering. He meant that. And he's also, I heard anger in that, a disappointment. I heard a lot of things in that commentary, 4 minutes. Let me welcome in our guests. Of course, Roderick Morrow, the black guy who tips, theblackguywhotips.com, and the best cold-bloodedest T-Rump impersonator ever to exist on this side of New Jersey. Let me welcome lawyer extraordinaire. He's got shows everywhere where he's going to be Trump. I told him he does not have to be Trump today because I actually don't want to hear the voice. Let me welcome JL Coven. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here. Thank you.
Actually, the same voice. I feel like you've done a mind meld. I don't know if your own voice.
No. This is the voice. See, that's the voice you don't want to hear.
Stop
she
it.
Made it happen. She did. Yeah.
Shut up.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let me start with you. Who most people who are white can't tell that you're black. Were you offended by what Barack Obama said, and to black men and? How did you take it?
No, but I can anticipate one of the first arguments against him, which is he's talking about our women having our backs. And obviously he's married to a black woman, but you know, an easy thing is like, well, you were raised by a white woman and white grandparents. So like your connection is not as strong or as deep. I'm just saying, so it no, I'm telling you, you're giving me a look. Look at what they've done to Kamala Harris, saying that she's not black. So I'm just saying, a naysayer, not everybody, but somebody who wants to come at this with an argument, will bring up that like his white mother gives him a different perspective where he's lecturing. I'm telling you right now,
his point was, even if it's 2%, because I did the numbers, we're talking about 2% of the electorate.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, let them do whatever they want. I'm not going to sit here and try to beg somebody to do something for their own good. We're going to show up and do what we need to do, and they'll benefit from us doing what we normally do. Anybody that's not going to show up, the 2% of the black men that won't show up, that's fine. You know, like I've abdicated that, right? So
I think this election is going to be too close that Obama knows it's too, like, to even give up on 2% is not a luxury we can have because I think, you know my joke about Democrats being the single moms of America. And I think on a smaller level, it's like black people are the single moms of the Democratic Party. So you can't, if Obama gets up there and goes, white people, what the hell is going on? More of you need to vote for Democrats. it's going to actually alienate some white people who are like, what? So he's doing the thing, which is like, I need to go where I think we can still change minds the most. So it comes off as a lecture and an attack on the most loyal base, similar to Democrats always being blamed for America's problems when they're the ones doing the lion's share of the work. Within the Democratic Party, it becomes a thing of, I don't want to lecture. I want to first acknowledge, you know, whatever is 90% of black women, 82%, 85% of black men, whatever the percentages are. And but we can see more movement there potentially than by complaining about the obvious, which is white voters haven't voted for a Democrat since 1964. Like, right. a Democrat has not won.
They're right. Not coming back.
Which is so crazy because Donald Trump is, of course, the best example of worst case scenario. Like, well, they have to come back if like a 1940s style incompetent racist ran. Like, that would be the point, right? Where they'd say, okay, that's too much. And it's not, which means, like you said, they're not coming back.
Right.
As a percentage.
Yeah, I think obviously, I share his frustration with that small percentage of brothers that for some reason can't get excited about a black woman president, you know, like just because I know in 2008, I watched those same people be super excited about a black man president. Some of us just.
And that was his point. That was his only point. Like he was actually in the trenches, so he can feel the palpable difference.
Exactly. So I share some of those frustrations. I mean, we've all, if you've been on the internet, if you've gone play basketball, gone to a barbershop, we all know a couple people that talk this way where you're like, really? Like, I just feel like if she was a man, we wouldn't even be talking about this shit. Like, you would just be like, yeah, yeah, no, I'm a vote. But this is, you know, a little bit different coded, probably from just years and years and years of people fighting over gender wars within in the community. So you got people that just like see a black woman and they're like, absolutely not. Or just I'll never feel good about it. So I understand that. I think also he was talking to a room of black men. It was kind of because I thought when I first saw it, I thought this was in his 45-minute speech he gave. Right. That's how people were sharing it. And I was like, whoa, he in the speech? That's wild. And he didn't. It was in a room of like-minded black men. And I like the pivot of when we see these people in our community, we can't like we have to go out and confront that logic. We have to bring that to them. And that part I absolutely agree with. And I live by that. That being said, I do understand the people that feel resentment because it's been like it's been a couple times that he's done this, like, kind of coming down on people, where on black people specifically, like when he's at a graduation speech and he's talking about Pookie and Ray Ray and people not raising their kids. Well, those aren't the people here. Like, the people here went to college. Right. They did the right stuff. We don't want to hear a speech about the people doing the wrong stuff. We want to hear a speech about, you know, uplifting the folks that are here. I think people would have liked to hear. And look, but those weren't his whole remarks. I noticed the clip I saw online cut off right as he was switching into like, and so that's why we got to be like this and we are doing this. And I was like, damn, y'all just cut. I want to hear the whole thing, because if he pivoted to some praise of the black men in that room, then that is as much part of the narrative as the admonishment of the black men, not in that room. Right.
Right.
So all that stuff being said, I'm not offended. But I very rarely get offended by any of this stuff. I do empathize and understand brothers who feel like, yo, we are the second most loyal voting bloc for Democrats. And I've said on this show before, I do find it to be part of the misinformation cycle to try to turn this into black men are abandoning to Kamala Harris and the Democrats for Trump. It's not true. The right. vast majority of us in every poll, every exit poll, we will always be voting Democrat. I'm not saying there won't be some people falling off, but that is actually true of all demographics. Even That's black right. women had some people that voted more for Trump the second time. I have no idea That's why. Right. But every demographic had some of that. So I don't know why black men get singled out as the problem. And that's before you get to the specific numbers. I don't like it, though.
I don't like it either. It's how you set how you frame a thing, right? Yeah. You don't have the license to chastise people when in many ways the institutions of the Democratic Party have been the problem. You have created barriers for entry for people who need to have these conversations with you. And there's an elitism that has been baked in to the Democratic Party that I think has hurt it over the years. It's not a big tent. It's not as big a tent as it needs to be. It's the biggest tent that we have, but it could be bigger. It could be bigger. And, you know, you're bringing up Jamie Harrison. We should talk about that as well. He lost with the most money ever. Why did you give him the keys to do something? We need something radical, right, at this point.
That's because he was my classmate at Georgetown Law, so he had the jail jinx.
Oh, that makes sense. I see. That's your fault. Yeah. It's your fault. Maybe we should kick you off this show, too, because I can't stand. I can't have any.
Get out!
I can't. All right, well, jail.
My days are cooler. Nights are warmer.
And finally for today, we have from the readout. Joy Reid breaks it down with her guests. Thanks for listening today.
If there is one thing you can count on every election cycle, it's the countless headlines about black voters shifting to Donald Trump. It's the train that's never late. We start this week with the media's favorite parlor game, powered by a New York Times Siena oversample poll, meaning they plussed up a relatively small sample of their main poll, and which the Times chose to report as follows, quote, black voters drift from Democrats, imperiling Harris's bid, poll shows. Their poll shows Harris leading Trump 78-15. Now, what's odd is that their poll contradicts a number of other recent polls and history that say otherwise. A Howard University poll from September shows Harris leading Trump among black voters in swing states 82-12. A CBS YouGov poll released just a day after the New York Times showed Harris leading Trump 87-12 among black voters. The debate about black voters also got a turbo boost from former President Barack Obama's message to men, and black men in particular, who might have hang-ups about voting for a woman. Over the weekend, Vice President Harris spoke with a popular social media destination, The Shade Room, think TMZ for black folks, where she responded to questions about Obama's message.
What is also important is, one, to understand, like, as I said, I intend to earn the vote of everyone, including black men. Two, pay attention to everything that President Obama talked about, because he also talked about, at length, the danger of Donald Trump. The danger of Donald Trump in terms of somebody who has said that they would weaponize the Department of Justice against his political enemies, somebody who has referred to black immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, legal immigrants, as though they would eat their pets, constantly perpetuating tropes.
The vice president also sat down with Roland Martin for a comprehensive conversation about a broad range of issues, from the economy to education, criminal justice and housing reform, Africa policy, voter apathy, and disenfranchisement.
Don't let anybody take you out the game. There is an intent to make it more difficult. There is an intent to suggest to a lot of folks that their vote won't matter, with the intention that people will not vote, which is an attempt to silence folks. This election is going to be no different. They've already started with the misinformation and the lies.
Just today, Harris rolled out a series of policies for what she calls her opportunity agenda for black men, which includes forgivable business loans for black entrepreneurs, more apprenticeships for black male teachers, more research for sickle cell disease and other diseases that disproportionately affect African-American men. She's also calling for measures that ensure that black men have opportunities to participate as a national cannabis industry takes shape. By contrast, Donald Trump has laid out no policies that address specific concerns of most black voters. And no, Ice Cube's platinum plan is not on his Agenda 47 website. That's Ice Cube's thing. Joining me now is Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network and host of Politics Nation right here on MSNBC, and Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia School of Journalism and staff writer for The New Yorker. I love saying dean of the Columbia Journalism. Our dean is black. We love that. Okay, so let's talk about this. I just want to go in. It's just from a journalistic point of view, because you did write a really good piece in The New Yorker about this. This trope that just comes around, I can go through all of the times it's been said. Headlines show Trump is going to win in 2016. Trump predicts he can win 95% of the black vote. Trump and the black vote, is there a road to redemption? That's 2016. 2020, the Federalist. Why Trump's gains with black voters could swing the 2020 election. What's happening out there with black men and Trump? Lil Wayne, Ice Cube, 50 Cent. Trump makes the final push for black voters. Like every time. Then we come to today. Trump is gaining ground with some black men. Here's how Harris can change their mind. Polls suggest Republicans are making gains. Trump courts rappers. It literally is a train that's never late.
Right.
And it's literally never true.
Yeah, I mean, first off, Black America is not waiting on Lil Wayne to tell us, like, how we're supposed to vote. No disrespect. But the other part of it, I think, is that, you know, this is the lowest form of journalism, the kind of poll chasing. Like, this thing happens, that thing happens. And then what you wind up doing is reifying statistical noise. You know, things that are outliers then become to seem like they are mainline, you know, they're valid assessments of what's going on. There's another thing here, which is fundamental, but if I were in a newsroom talking about this, I would say the old claim, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the level of loyalty, this number is 78 to 15, there's not a scenario, not a realistic scenario in which Kamala Harris winds up with a smaller portion of, but less than 80% of the black vote, and likely far north of that.
Right.
But if you are going to make that claim, you need a lot more than one poll, a lot more than an oversample and a single poll. You need a consistent trend line that shows across various polls and various times and various places that this is where this vote is headed. We don't see that.
Right. I mean, and we'll talk about this another day, but, you know, Maria Chisakumar from Voto Latino, they did a big, huge, like 3,000 person sample poll, which is very different from when the New York Times did their oversample of Latino voters. Very different numbers. And I mean, the thing about it is, Riff, you will find what you're looking for. You can go into a barbershop and find sure. that one contrary brother that's like, I like Trump. Like, right. I could find that, right? But that's mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that that one guy or that one rapper who's like doing a video for Trump represents black men broadly. But if you're looking for that and you want to make a package about that, you can find that guy. And I think the problem with that is you go all the way back. Let's go back to Clinton era. Clinton, Dole got 15%. 2000, when Al Gore was running, Bush got 12%. You can go to 2004, you were running for president, Bush got 13%. McCain got 5%. Romney got 11%. Trump got 14%. Trump got 12% in 2020. There are simply about 11 to 14% of black men who've been Republicans and been voting Republicans since 68. Mm-hmm. So you can keep finding those same brothers over and over again. That is not a trend.
Well, no, it is definitely something that we've seen. His vote has been consistent with Republicans before him. And in 20, he was even 2 or 3 points lower than the Republican candidate. So a lot of these polls are just their projections from some people with a narrow polling base. But the thing that I would challenge is some of these guys, the rappers, give us what his policies are right. for black America. We demand that of a black woman
yeah.
who laid it out today. A million people given loans, if they given forgivable loans,
yeah.
They will let it go at $20,000 if you've got something that's viable. That's a business plan. They claim to be businessmen, a lot of these rappers. And on to the medical support and et cetera. I don't even understand how we're even talking about Donald Trump and business in the same sentence when we had an $8.3 trillion deficit and a supply chain disruption. He did nothing to stop the price gouging that some of the people were doing. He was president then.
Right.
He was president when George Floyd happened, president when Breonna Taylor happened, president when Ahmaud Arbery happened. What did he do? Oh, he got a Bible, went across the street, had the Secret Service clear protesters, and condemned the protesters. So what are we going to think he's going to do that he didn't do in the 4 years he was there?
WRCT, Pittsburgh. Consolidation is up next.
This is a production of PBRTV.com. Now, another hour of friendly talk and great music on Smooth, Relaxing, and Easy on Tube City Online Radio, Vulcan Sound Radio, and 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org.
Voice out. What are the flight back of the sky? I would look back or sit the man inside and chill.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Vibrations and